And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning and welcome to the program. A few minutes past midnight of March 24th, 1989, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground in Alaska's Prince William Sound. The ship was torn open, spilling 240,000 barrels of oil into the water, hundreds of times more oil than had been released in any previous accident. It turned out that it was a spill that no one, not Exxon, not the oil industry, the state government of Alaska, or the federal government was prepared to deal with. And it is the story that this morning's first guest, Art Davidson, tells in his book, In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, subtitled The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. It is a book that has been recently published by Sierra Club Books. In the coverage of this accident, of course, much of the attention was focused on the captain of the Exxon Valdez, Joseph Hazelwood. His drinking problems became a matter of record. So did, actually, his seamanship, which earned him a master's license at the age of 32. That's 10 years earlier than most Exxon captains receive that rating. Hazelwood graduated from New York Maritime College with honors. The motto printed next to his picture, though, showed that perhaps he was confident and maybe too confident. It read, "It can't happen to me." It would be very easy to put the blame for the accident on Captain Hazelwood. However, our guest this morning suggests that there is plenty of blame to go around, and I would just like to read a few lines from one portion of the book where he writes this. Some federal, state, and private investigators who pored over evidence of the Exxon Valdez grounding came to the conclusion that the event was not really an accident. They cast blame in many directions. A few even raised the possibility of an out-and-out conspiracy to account for the myriad things that shouldn't have gone wrong but did. That suggestion aside, it's certain that a conspiracy of sorts was at work, an unconscious conspiracy of denial. A tanker captain denied his drinking problem. A harbor pilot and tanker crew members denied their responsibility to report breaches of safety regulations. Company officials denied the potential consequences of crew fatigue and of placing an alcoholic captain in command of an oil tanker. Coast Guard officials denied the necessity of following their own safety procedures. In retrospect, the wreck of the Exxon Valdez appeared to be less an accident than a widespread denial that such an incident could happen at all. It seemed as if everyone involved had adopted Joe Hazelwood's yearbook motto, "It can't happen to me." This morning, our guest, Art Davidson, is joining us from Alaska by telephone. He's been an Alaska resident since 1964. His pursuits have included protecting wildlife and establishing new parks and refuges in Alaska. He has served as Friends of the Earth Alaska representative and Alaska's director of the John Muir Institute for Environmental Studies. For the past several years, he's been working with Native Alaskans to help them preserve their traditional lifestyles and values. With the Yupik Eskimo chiefs of Northwest Alaska, he produced the highly acclaimed film Our Land, Our Life. He's written a lot about Alaska and his experiences there. He made a historic first winter ascent of Mount McKinley in 1967 and retold that story in his book Minus 148, First Winter Ascent of Mount McKinley. In 1989, he wrote some 30 stories and essays about man's connections with nature in Alaska, and they were published with a collection of Art Wolf's photographs in the book Alakshak, A Great Country. That's a Sierra Club book also. And before the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built, our guest, Art Davidson, was an outspoken critic of its potential problems, particularly the chances of a large oil spill in Prince William Sound. As we talk this morning with our guest, you are invited to call in. Perhaps you will have some questions or comments. You'd like to share some of your thoughts with us. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Our number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Davidson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We really appreciate it. Especially
I appreciate the chance to talk to you and your listeners.
That's good.
We've had a lot of people from your part of the country concerned about the spill, and of course we get a lot of people visiting up here too.
Yeah, I was also going to say we especially appreciate it because it's rather early there.
I'm having my first cup of coffee, so if I sound not too coherent, that's maybe the reason.
Okay. It does. That little passage that I read, for me, I think really seems to be an important theme for the story that you tell. The fact that no one was prepared to deal with this oil spill, I think in large part because they didn't believe that, it could happen. Or either that, or they, and I'm not sure whether they actually thought that it wouldn't happen, or they were just hoping that it wouldn't happen. Which do you think it was?
Well, you know, I've got to say, I'm really touched that you pulled that paragraph out. It really is, to me, the heart of so much of what happened here. In fact, I should tell you that the working title, my working title for the book for several months was In the Wake of Denial. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to me, as I began to explore this event that was called an accident, that we'd really set it up. We'd set the stage. And at the root of it, I was trying to get at the underlying reasons why something like this happens. You know, it shouldn't have to happen. Yeah. This was an accident that did not have to happen. And as I probed and explored, it just seems like so many people in so many places, from officials in the government to oil company officials to, you know, just regular citizens of Alaska, we became complacent. We denied the risks of what we were doing.
Well, I'd like to talk first about maybe some of the events surrounding the accident itself, and then also talk about the cleanup effort. And I suppose the natural place to begin is to talk a little bit about Captain Hazelwood, since so much of the attention focused on him, and both, as I said, both his record, which before this accident had been, at least in terms of his performance, how rapidly he rose in the company, how well he did in his nautical training, was very good, and at the same time it came out that the man had a pretty significant drinking problem. And when you look at the events of that night, it does seem that he made several mistakes. Certainly he did several things that were breaches of procedure, so I suppose the question one has to ask is the one man who's most responsible, the one man who could have prevented this from happening, is that Joe Hazelwood?
Well, you know, there's that temptation always when something happens to find someone to blame. And sometimes one person may clearly be to blame. But in this case, I think we focus so much attention on Hazelwood that we haven't looked hard enough at our own responsibility, and especially responsibility of, you know, state and federal agencies. You know, Hazelwood did make mistakes, and he evidently had a drinking problem. We know he had a drinking problem, and evidently he was drinking that night. But you see, to me, if we make Hazelwood the scapegoat for the whole thing, we're not really learning the lessons. And one of the lessons to me of this kind of thing is that there's always going to be human error. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be a captain who, if he doesn't drink, maybe he gets dizzy at the critical moment. Maybe he reads a chart wrong. Maybe he has a heart attack. And so what you have to do is you have to build in safeguards. You've got to make sure that there's another qualified officer on the bridge. You've got to make sure that those Coast Guard people that are supposed to be watching these tankers on their radar screen make sure that they're doing their job and are ready to warn a tanker if they get off the track. And so there again is that sense of denial. We all sort of denied that this could happen, and then everything, things started slipping through the cracks and added up to this accident.
Mm-hmm. It seemed that there were some opportunities along the way for either removing the captain from command or making sure that he wouldn't have been there. For example, the Coast Guard, as you mentioned in the book, the Coast Guard renewed his master certification even though his driver's license had been revoked because of drunk driving.
Right. You would think that would be a simple thing for the Coast Guard to check when they're renewing licenses. Do these people that they're renewing licenses do they have a drinking record? Do they have a problem with it? And that was not done. Now, alarmingly, I had various people within the industry tell me that Hazelwood is not the only person who drinks aboard those ships, and that there are a number of captains that are, if not out-and-out alcoholic, have drinking problems. I can't verify that, and I don't go into that in great length in the book, but when you've got that potential, you've got to really ferret out every possible problem, like a person's drinking problem. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think Exxon could have done a better job of handling Hazelwood once they knew that he had a drinking problem, and they knew ahead of time. It had been reported to him. They knew that he was in a rehabilitation program, and in my opinion, they should have removed him from that critical position, put him in another position where his seamanship and his great expertise could be put to use, but he wouldn't be, putting so many people and so many natural resources at risk.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you mentioned, the fact that the tankers that we use today are highly automated, which makes it possible for a smaller crew to operate the ship. But it also means that in many cases, people are working much longer than they should be. They're maybe very fatigued. Are there some things you can say about perhaps either the way that these ships are designed or staffed or run that maybe somehow contributed to this accident happening?
Well, I think, I can talk about that a little. I think there's some trade-offs in the way that these tankers have developed over the last 10 years or so. They're more mechanized. There's more electronic equipment. There are more automated systems on the ship. And so to run under normal circumstances, they require fewer people. Now, this, of course, saves the company, the shipping company, money, which they're striving to do. Theoretically, and in many instances, it also eliminates extra human error. There are fewer people there to make human errors. And then, of course, you're relying on the electronics and so forth. To me, one of the problems with this move towards smaller crews and more automation is that while it works fine under normal circumstances, when you get in that critical situation where one or two crew members become ill, or you have a storm, or you have something like this particular night where you had the ice conditions and you had, heading towards this Bligh Reef, when you reach those critical moments, sometimes you need extra people. And that's where I think that this move towards smaller and smaller crews has a real downside to it.
One other thing that you also address in the book, and that is the role of the Coast Guard, which is really charged with making this area safe for ships to travel, and to make sure that there are regulations, that regulations are followed. It seems that one could, in a sense, fault the Coast Guard for not enforcing its own regulations, and at the same time, you also mentioned that perhaps the Coast Guard wasn't really given the resources to be able to do the job that it was assigned, and there we have a government problem.
You betcha. You know, the first of all, the specific on that night, what happened was the Coast Guard station was put in Valdez for the specific purpose of monitoring these tankers in and out of Valdez. Now, they do other Coast Guard types of duties with other types of ships, but that was the reason that the station was put there. And they have a radar room back in Valdez where they are supposed to watch the ships coming into Valdez, these big tankers, and watch them leaving. And if a ship wants to leave these designated traffic lanes, then they have to radio the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is supposed to watch them carefully. Well, here's what happened the night of the so-called accident. The crew shift, the accident happened just a few moments after midnight. So about 15 minutes before midnight, the crew shift changed in the Valdez Coast Guard radar station. A new man came on. He rearranged his papers. Then he went and had a cup of coffee. And as he told the National Transportation Safety Board later, he went to get coffee, check on the weather. He wasn't sure how long he was gone from the radar room. When he came back, we had the worst tanker oil spill accident in our nation's history. And see, there just wasn't the vigilance that we need. He should have known, and I believe did know, that tanker was off its lane. He should have been watching it. He should have had the right kind of equipment so there was a clear image out there. And those things didn't happen. So one could say that the Coast Guard was, they could have prevented this from happening. but they didn't. So then you say, well, is it just the fault of that one Coast Guard man, or is it, or does this represent a trend or some movement in the Coast Guard to not be as vigilant? When you start exploring, you find that over the last 10 years or so, and especially after, over the last 5 or 6, the Coast Guard budgets have been cut back and been cut back. People have been transferred out of Valdez and not replaced. There are fewer men. Some of the equipment is not up to snuff. And one of the drains on this, ironically, is the move to have the Reagan administration's to have the Coast Guard fight the war on drugs. And so a lot of Coast Guard personnel have been pulled off of pollution-type activities and guarding our coasts in the traditional sense. So there was a general deterioration. And, you know, the Coast Guard budget was cut year after year, and they were in a situation where when the crisis came, they weren't well prepared to handle their job.
Well, let me just, for anybody who may have tuned in the past few minutes, reintroduce our guest this morning. His name is Art Davidson. He is the author of the book In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, which is about the impact of that Alaska oil spill that occurred in March of 1989. We're talking with him this morning. He's joining us by telephone from Alaska. If you have questions for us, so you can give us a call. The local number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do have somebody standing by on one of our local lines, our line number 1, and let's talk with them. Good morning.
Good morning. I have to admit that I followed the Exxon Valdez story really quite heavily, and I followed it basically through NPR radio. So with a little outside verification on network news. But I was troubled by something, and I'd like your guest just to respond. And the thing that troubled me is I believe that I'll say this in a sort of a radical way, the virtual virtual witch hunt that went on with Hazelwood, it really disturbed me. I felt it was not only a smokescreen to basically occupy our minds while the important issues of the matter sort of got lost as time passed, but the fact that everything I could see from the day I first heard about this story till the trial and everything is that Hazelwood have a drinking problem? I guess I would say, yeah, I'm sure he did. But it does never seem to me that that caused the problem. I mean, when you have the entire crew basically saying, no, you know, I mean, he gave this command, it was the correct command. He thought the command was executed, on and on and on. And I actually think it's criminal that he was terrorized in the way that he was. The guy had a problem. He had a medical problem. I just think that it was a smoke. What I'm saying is, look, I don't really care about Hazelwood all that much, I suppose. I'm glad he basically didn't have to serve any jail time because I don't think he'd even deserve to go to trial. But I believe it was all smokescreen. It was this thing of, hey, let's focus on some concrete person to blame instead of looking at the whole thing. And like when the stuff about the Coast Guard started to come out and all these things, I started just to shake my head and go, they're putting Hazelwood on trial? The guy's not even watching the radar screen in the Coast Guard station. Why in the heck isn't he on trial? I mean, I wouldn't really want him on trial because people make mistakes. But yeah, I just want your guests to respond because I felt like we were being given, even on NPR, basically a little soap opera instead of the real issue. Now, I do know that NPR did run some good stories, but I mean the general day-to-day coverage was, to me, immature. Anyway, but I'll sign off, and I'm really glad to have the program.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call. Art, can you respond to what the caller had to say?
Well, I appreciate that comment very, very much, and I, you know, this caller echoes many of my own sentiments. You know, Hazelwood did make he could have handled his responsibility better. He did make some errors, but the fact is, he's not solely responsible for this accident. Now, I think that many people had it was to their advantage to have the attention focused on Hazelwood. If for Exxon, for example. If they could, if this whole thing was perceived as human error on one person's part, that left them innocent of cutting back their crews, of what their other crew members should have been doing, of catching this person in their review and noticing he had alcoholic problems. But you see, we all fed into this thing. I think we all wanted. I mean, I'm talking about a society in general that we sort of go to find the one person who's caused the problem. I think the media tended to be like, and sometimes like a pack of wolves, and went for the wounded animal. And here was the wounded animal. Here was Hazelwood. Here's the one that they all went after. And as a consequence, sort of as part of this whole cycle, it feeds into this denial. We don't want to look at the more widespread responsibility, Coast Guard, state and federal agencies, and then eventually back to ourselves as consumers and as voters. We're the ones that voted for the congressman that, you know, cut back the Coast Guard budgets. So I would agree that too much has been made of Hazelwood, and that if we make him a scapegoat, we're just, in a sense, we're reinforcing our position as victims and not taking responsibility for it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the fact that so much attention was focused on Captain Hazelwood, was that at all engineered by Exxon as part of their public relations campaign in this?
Well, that's hard to say. I think that Exxon benefited public relations-wise to have the blame pinned on Exxon. So I think that they probably contributed to it as they could. They didn't step up and raise other issues. They were quite probably, I don't know if happy is the right word, but I think that they were content if the blame was laid on Exxon and probably did some things to reinforce that. But I don't know if we can say that Exxon engineered it. You see, the national press were in there, and the reporters, and Hazelwood was a story of the day. Mm-hmm. And so he was followed very, very carefully and scrutinized. And it was more difficult, I think, particularly at first, to look at the underlying reasons and the widespread blame. These things were hidden. And Exxon was not particularly anxious to talk about how they'd lobbied for, you know, crew cutbacks and so forth. The Coast Guard was not particularly anxious to talk about what their man could have done differently. They tried to, I would say, cover that up. I've seen some Coast Guard officials doing what I would call as a real sort of verbal shuffle to cover up their responsibility. The state of Alaska, likewise, could have done a much better job of monitoring the tanker operations in Valdez, but failed in its job, and so it didn't really want to talk about that. And so it's, I think, a lot of attention fell on Hazelwood.
Mm. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we're talking this morning with Art Davidson. He's joining us by telephone from Alaska. We're talking with him about his book, In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. His book is published by Sierra Club Books. And if you have questions, we welcome them. Our telephone number is locally is 333-9455, and we have the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, somebody standing by on our toll-free line, so why don't we talk with them? Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to agree with the last caller on the unjust criticism of Hazelwood. And to continue on that, I noticed you mentioned something about losing a driver's license should be considered within getting a license for shipping. And I fail to see a real connection in that because, okay, I haven't had a drink in about a year and a half, yet if I go out and get loaded and get a DWI, I wouldn't expect my employer to say, okay, now you can't work for us. You're no longer qualified because you went out and drank like a sailor on shore leave or so, and I think that might be what happened to Hazelwood, and there's not always a direct connection between, say, driving drunk and working drunk. And I'm wondering what you think, Mr. Davidson, should be the connection between drunk driving and, say, a shipping license or drunk driving and anything, whether you're a forest ranger or what. Should a forest ranger who gets caught for driving drunk, should he then have to go and, say, relearn forestry?
Well, I would say this, that it's a complicated... I appreciate your question because it's not just a black and white question and matter. But I would say this, that, for example, if we're flying on an airplane, if you and I are going on a trip, and we are told just before the flight takes off that our captain and pilot has lost his driver's license on the ground several times because of drinking problems. I don't know about you, but I get off the plane. And I guess the point I want to make is that where you have a lot of responsibility placed in the hands of a single person or two or three people, responsibility for human life or for, you know, keeping something like this disastrous oil spill from happening, we want to make sure, we ask the extra step, the extra mile, the extra bit of responsibility of that person. And they shouldn't, people that have drinking problems, in my opinion, established over several years, not just one binge or something, not just one DWI, but have repeatedly lost their license. People like that, in my opinion, should not be in those critical positions of being, you know, airplane captains or captains on oil tankers. They shouldn't necessarily be fired. I think that their competence should be, and technically should be put to use in other parts of the company, if at all possible. One of the ironies is of this whole alcohol problem for companies, and it's not just oil companies and their tanker captains, but for many, many large companies, is if they have a policy of firing employees who drink, then those who have a drinking problem are not going to come forward in any way and say, look, I need help, I need rehabilitation, I need to go to a clinic, I need counseling. They won't come forward, and they'll remain hidden, and they won't seek any cure or any help. So on the other hand, what companies have gone to is a confidential program. An employee can come to, through his health benefits, can get into a counseling program without the company knowing about it and seek help that way. On the other hand, the downside to that is if you have a man in a critical position like the captain, his supervisors may not know about it, and his problem may contribute to an accident later on. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, by kind of a strange circumstance, Exxon found out, and Exxon knew that Hazelwood had a drinking problem ahead of time. In fact, Hazelwood had been named in a lawsuit by another Exxon employee and was accused of drinking and harassing other employees while on duty. So with that kind of a background, not just once but a number of times, getting into fights, his license revoked, you know, I think that's a significant problem that either Exxon or the Coast Guard should have caught and should have corrected. On the other hand, as we go back and look at the whole situation, we can't pin the whole grounding, let alone the catastrophic cleanup, on Hazelwood and whether or not he was drunk to what degree on the night of the accident.
Yeah. I want to go on and make sure that we do talk a little bit about what happened after the accident.
Yeah.
And especially to talk about the plan that existed or supposedly existed to deal with this kind of situation. There was apparently a plan developed by by Alyeska, which is the consortium of oil companies that were involved there at Valdez, which apparently, at least they told the state of Alaska, that if there was a spill, they could deal with it. And in fact, their plan said that within the first 72 hours of any spill, they would be able to collect 100,000 barrels of oil. And actually what happened within that time span, the first 72 hours, they barely managed to collect 3,000 barrels, and it was probably no better than if you sent a bunch of fishing boats out there with people with buckets to scoop it up. They could have done at least that well, and I guess did. What happened? Why was it that the contingency plan that apparently made everybody feel that they could take care of this if it happened didn't work?
Well, this was just an outrageous comedy of errors, and more than error. You see, from the very beginning, when the oil companies discovered this oil and began arguing for a pipeline down to Valdez and then transfer the oil to tankers, we were told, the people of Alaska and the people of this country were told by the industry, that, first of all, a large spill was highly, highly unlikely, but that if it ever did happen, they could clean it up. They had the state-of-the-art equipment. They had the booms and the skimmers. The booms are like ropes that sort of contain the oil on the surface of the water. They had these skimming boats that worked like, you know, sort of vacuum cleaners out there in the water. And that they had the equipment, the manpower, the expertise to handle a spill. And the state and federal regulators, the watchdogs, our own public officials that are supposed to be making sure that everything is safe and in order, they went along with the industry. They never stood up to the industry and demanded to see if their equipment and their expertise was adequate. And what we learned with the Exxon Valdez is that it was not adequate. It was totally inadequate, and that we'd really been misled by the industry for years, and our public officials didn't really investigate thoroughly.
But it's sort of your suggestion that, again, that perhaps people there in Alaska, they wanted the economic development that would come with the doing the oil work, and they wanted to believe that the cleanup plan would work, and they just sort of, nobody really pushed it. Nobody said, well, okay, you're telling us that you can do this, but we really want to see some concrete proof. You know, we really want to know that you can do it. It was sort of, well, we'll take your word on it. And it was because people really wanted, you know, because they wanted to have the oil business there.
You betcha. And that goes right back to what you were talking about at first, and that's that sense of denial.
Yeah.
People tend to, and whether it's Alaska or elsewhere, we tend to want our cake and eat it too. And up here, this oil promised to bring riches to Alaska, and so people in the state of Alaska, many, many people said, well, heck, we know how to handle this stuff. We can take care of it. The oil industry is saying it's safe. Let's go ahead and do it. I don't think people consciously at the beginning said, we want this oil even if it does ruin the environment. Rather, they believed, they were so prone, they were so set to believe the promises and assurances of the oil industry that they went along with it. Mm-hmm. And they weren't critical when they should have been critical. They weren't careful. They weren't watchful.
There's something else that's sort of odd about the way that the relationship between the government and the oil industry is structured in this kind of situation. It seems that the government, almost by the way that the laws were written, the government could not work with the spiller on the cleanup. The government could only come in afterwards if it felt the company hadn't done a good enough job. And it seems that seems to have hampered a lot of people who wanted to work together, and somehow there was just too much red tape, or the regulation said you couldn't do it. It couldn't be a cooperative effort.
That's right. Once the spill happened, it became sort of a Roman circus of people wondering what they could do, what they should do. It became very confusing. Now, to back up just a second, I think it's important to keep in mind that not just Exxon, but the other oil companies in that Alyeska consortium, companies like ARCO and British Petroleum, they had the responsibility, mandated by Congress, to be ready for an oil spill in this vicinity. See, one of the frightening things is that in Valdez, there was supposedly the best contingency plan, the best oil spill plan in the whole country. It was recognized from the beginning that this was a beautiful natural area, that a spill would be devastating, and therefore Congress mandated special care there. And it can be argued that the industry was better prepared there than anywhere else to protect our shores. Well, what we found out was when the spill happened, the other oil companies treated it just like a hot potato. They didn't want to be out front taking the criticism, and they weren't prepared. And we have to, even though there hasn't been too much talk of companies like British Petroleum, we have to keep in mind that they're the majority stockholder, shareholder in the pipeline operation, and they could have taken the leadership role to make sure that all those companies were ready for a major spill. Well, anyway, what happened was, in the very early hours, the Alyeska Consortium handed the response off to Exxon. They basically said, look, this is not a little spill. This is a big one. We're not going to all take the heat. And by we, I mean the other oil companies for this. It's your spill, Exxon. Are you going to come up here and take care of it? And Exxon said, we will. So while Alyeska was still trying to get out their tiny little flotilla of oil spill response boats to the tanker in the took them 9 hours instead of a promised two or three. Exxon, at the same time, started to mount their response from Texas. And it took them several days to fly their people up, get equipment in place, and begin to get ready to fight the spill. But We have to keep in mind there was another contingency plan in place at the time, and that was our government's. You see, there's a national contingency plan, which in effect is our government's guarantee that in return for all the tax money and in many cases royalties, all the money that the federal government receives from oil development, that they will be ready, the government will be ready to respond to an oil spill and clean it up if a spiller is not responsible. And what we found was that the Coast Guard and the federal government were less prepared than the oil industry. In their fund to take care of these types of things, they only had $5 million, which, and Exxon spent more than that in the first day. Hmm. One of the Coast Guard admirals said, look, it would take us 2 weeks just to get the paperwork straightened out so that we could begin hiring people and leasing equipment to go out and clean up this oil spill. And you know, an oil spill, it doesn't just sit there for you waiting day after day, week after week for you to pick it up. It's like a fire. It moves on through the house. And you have to get after it right away with every tool at your disposal if you're going to minimize its effect. Now, back to the question of how the government could have come in. The way we have it set up, the spiller is responsible, and until he fails in his response at cleaning up a spill, the government is supposed to sort of advise but not actually step in there and work with the spiller and physically try to help pick up the oil. Now, if the government notices that the spiller is having trouble, is not really doing the job, not really getting the oil picked up, it is supposed to step in and what we call federalize parts or all of the spill response. For example, they could federalize or take over rescuing of marine birds or rescuing of otters or rescuing of bald eagles. They could take over the shoreline cleanup. But what we found was, even though the government was supposed to be in a position to do that, the Coast Guard admirals and the other Coast Guard officials were arguing against federalizing the spill because they say we couldn't handle it as well as Exxon. But Exxon was obviously way in over there what they could handle, and they were floundering and they were not able to control it. So it was not just Exxon. Exxon made errors and was not prepared, but it was not just Exxon's fault, and not just either for the accident or the response afterwards.
Well, we have several callers who are waiting to talk with you, and I want to get back to the phones. And also, again, for people who may have tuned in, we're talking with Art Davidson. He is the author of the book In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, about the impact of that Alaska oil spill. His book is published by Sierra Club Books. We have several people who've been waiting patiently to talk with us, and let's go first to line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I work in the Natural History Survey, and we're wondering what the long-term environmental impacts of the area would be and what condition the shoreline's in right now.
Well, I can tell you that many of us are wondering what the long-term impacts are going to be. These are complicated ecological considerations. We know that so many birds died, approximately 100 to 200, 300,000 marine birds. We know how many sea otters were recovered, how many eagles were recovered. They make projections of how many animals and birds died overall. But once you get down to the subtler effects of the oil spill and what its long-term effects are going to be, it becomes very, very hard to know. Some biologists are saying it may take 20 to 70 years for some bird colonies to reestablish themselves. And that's really another way of saying we don't know how long it's going to take.
Uh-huh. Has a lot of oil drifted out to sea?
Well, has it gone probably, but no one really knows for sure. Mm-hmm. A lot of the oil hit the beaches. And you see, and when it hit the beaches, it began immediately working down into the sands and gravels. Now here, to me, is one of the incredible things that has somehow been covered up for this past year, is the fact that Exxon was never trying to get all of the oil cleaned up. I think most people in the country think that they were. But May of last year, they worked out an agreement where they were only going to treat the surface of the beaches. And most of the oil had worked down into the substrata, down into the rocks and the sands and the gravels. And, you know, that's where a lot of the oil is, and that's where a lot of those little marine organisms that are the basis of the food chain live. Mm-hmm. Now, I was out in Prince William Sound last week and walked the beaches. You know, you take a boat out there, and you're going out in the open water, and you see these beautiful islands pass, and it's just a very, I mean, it's just beautiful, and it's still beautiful. You come in towards a beach, and it still looks beautiful. And you step up on the sand and the rock, and at first you're tempted to say, "My gosh, it's clean, it's beautiful. I'm so happy. The winter storms have helped clean it, and Exxon's helped clean it." And then in many places you can walk up the beach line. You'll find an area where you turn a rock over, and there's this black, gooey oil. Hmm. In some places, it's still viscous, it's still soft and still stinks. In other places, you find it looks as if someone has splashed black paint up on the rocks. In other places, it's laying in patches on the sand. It looks like a rough asphalting job. Somebody done a shoddy asphalting job on our beaches. It's not everywhere, but it's in many places. And likelihood is that it's going to remain in the sand and the gravel for a long, long time.
Why isn't it being cleaned up right now?
Well, Exxon has, that's a good question. And, you know, Exxon does have some people out there trying to clean up the beaches. And the method this year that I saw last week is that they'll have a crew of 10 or 15 people with shovels and 5-gallon buckets. And when they come to a patch of beach that has oil in the sand and rocks, they begin shoveling the sand and rocks into the buckets. People hand carry these buckets sometimes to a little cart, and then it's carried to a ship and put in a bigger container. And these larger containers are then shipped down to Oregon and disposed of in a toxic waste a place. So in a sense, we're digging up our beaches and sending them off to Oregon. But the problem is, there's still, the question is, and the problem is, are they doing a thorough job? And are they going to stay there until all the oil is cleaned up? Now, I talked to the Coast Guard person who signs off on these beaches, and he says, and this is his word, he says, "I think it would be asinine for them to dig up every rock and every bit of sand that has oil in it." And this is what he said. He says, "That oil is going back to where it came from," meaning it's sinking back into the ground. Mm-hmm. So the indication I got was that they are willing to sign off. That means approve beaches and say it's clean, knowing full well that there is oil down in those rocks, down in the gravels, down in the substrata, and that oil, that could belch back up, leach back up in the future. But you'd also get into some real complicated trade-offs scientifically. Is it better to dig the entire beach up, scrub every sand and every rock, in some cases killing more organisms to get the oil out and then have a clean sort of seed bed for life to come back in? Or is it better to sort of leave some of those beaches intact and even knowing that there's some oil down in the rocks and sand? And what we find is we're being used as guinea pigs up here. And these beaches are being experimented on, and they don't really have any hard answers.
I wanted to jump in here and apologize to the last caller. I just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to try to get at least one more person in here before we have to finish.
Let's go.
No. You shouldn't apologize. Your answers are wonderful. I'm the one who feels bad because we don't have more time. So let me go on. We'll get one more caller here, line number two.
Okay.
Hello.
Just a short comment and question. The comment is that there was this earlier statement about helping cover it up and blame it on the captain. Press people learn very early that corporate responsibility stories are not good stories, that they aren't wanted. And if David Letterman does anything on his talk show, he reminds people that GE owns NBC. But anyway, the question is, what about double hull? What about that structural problem? And there's some controversy as to whether it would have made much difference in this case, but it probably would in a lot of cases. And obviously, Big Oil was lobbying against that in a large way. Thank you.
Yes. Briefly, when this oil was first shipped out of Alaska, we were told that there would be double hulls. They were believed to be much safer. Over the years, it never became a requirement. A few of the ships coming up here do have double hulls. Most of them don't. The Exxon Valdez, of course, did not. And studies after the accident indicate that a substantial portion of the oil could have been kept on board ship if there had been the double hull. In other words, the rock would not have punctured through both holes and then released as much oil.
We are unfortunately here at the point where we're going to have to stop. Your book goes into the story in a great deal of detail, and we've only managed to just touch on it. So I can just tell people if they would like to read more about this, they can go out and take a look at the book. Just as a final thought, do you feel that we have learned something from the accident of the Exxon Valdez?
I think the lessons are there to be learned. And one of the main lessons is that, and this is an oil, top oil company official who put it this way. He says a myth has been perpetuated, particularly in America. And the myth is that we know how to handle large oil spills. We don't. And he said we have to face this fair and square, both the public and the industry. The fact is, if we're going to be shipping large amounts of oil, whether it's from Alaska or the Middle East, whether it's along the West Coast or the East Coast, there will be big spills, and when it happens, it's going to get out of control. We cannot handle it. And that is a big lesson. Now, have we learned it? I'm not sure we have. And I think what people can do if they're concerned is they can write or call their own congressman and ask him to vote for double hulls, ask him to vote for strong liability laws and anti-pollution laws, and tighten these things up. We can set the rules for industry, and we don't have to be victims in the future.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it a lot.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Our guest once again this morning, Art Davidson, and his book, if you would like to take a look at it, is In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez. It's published by Sierra Club Books.